morning. Is this a thing now where we can swear from the stage so long as we cover the mic with our... Okay. Good morning. I'd like to start today with a suggestion that living is dying. In general, if we live an average lifespan here in the United States, we have something in the neighborhood of 4,000 weeks of life ahead of us when we are born. And by being born, we immediately start to subtract from that number. And at any given stage in our life, we have something less than what we had the day before. Living is dying, and it's hard to tell when that vague space between how we define living and how we define dying begins. If we were to look at an actuarial chart, we could potentially say, well, if our average lifespan is something like 80, then we start dying at the age of 40. I'm not prepared to say that. But from an actuarial standpoint, we could say that. We could also say that dying maybe begins as we start to really notice some significant functional decline. However we're going to define it, we have to come back to the opposite of the phrase, which is this: dying is living. That even in the midst of our dying, however we're going to choose to define that, there is yet life to be had. These are two sides of the same coin, and it's worth, I think, paying attention to that. So a few years ago, I was consulted to see a patient in the hospital who had been admitted overnight with severe pain related to her recurrent breast cancer. This woman had been diagnosed with recurrence of her breast cancer several months before, and she had metastatic disease involving her bone and liver and adrenal glands. She had stage 4 disease, and she was told that it was no longer possible to approach her disease as if it was curable, and that she was looking at a limited prognosis. The woman and her family chose to meet this news with positive mental attitude and faith in miracles. They hung a plaque at the entrance to her home that said, "Only positive energy allowed here." They refused to have any further discussions about things like approaching death, and instead used phrases like, "She's a fighter. She has courage. There are new cures that happen every day." They prayed hard and invited people of their faith community into their home frequently to pray for healing. They participated in healing rituals. They became very adept at exploring the internet and looking for alternative therapies here in the U.S. and even abroad. Her cancer progressed. It was evident on imaging studies. It was evident also in functional decline. She had increased weakness, and it also became evident in increasing pain. She became involved with a pain service in an attempt to help manage all of this, and she was on continually escalating doses of potent narcotics. They would seem to help for a little while, but her pain continued to worsen. The day before I was asked to see her, she had presented to the emergency department in a pain crisis, and they had admitted her overnight. She was on robust doses of methadone, Dilaudid, gabapentin, and muscle relaxers. She had refused any Ativan or Valium, though, because she insisted that she was not anxious. When I walked in to visit with her and her family, there was a great deal of tension in the room. Despite all that she had done, she was dying. And the fact was inescapable. She was thin, she was frail and weak, and finally, in her frailty and in her weakness, she was willing to talk about her impending death. Her husband was there with her. She was able to express a lot of anger and specifically the sense of how unfair all of this was, that she had worked so hard and prayed so hard and tried to do everything right. She was able to express a great deal of grief at dying at a young age, being forced to say goodbye to her loving family and missing out. She cried hard. Her husband cried. And eventually, the tension in the room began to subside. As we continued talking, and as she let go of her denial of her terminal diagnosis and her impending death, it started to seem to me like she was breathing a little easier. And at some point, a little later on, I asked her how her pain was. She paused, expressed some surprise, and said, Actually, it's a little better now. A couple of days later, she left the hospital. She went home with hospice care, and within a week or so, she died. But during those several days, her pain became much more manageable on much lower doses of narcotics. And it seemed to me that she did find some peace in those last few days, and I hope that she and her family viewed this as a good death. Finitude. We are finite beings. We are confronted in life with an inevitable flow of time. We are finite in our time of actually living. And in fact, this amount of time can seem terrifyingly short. As I mentioned earlier, we look at something like 4,000 weeks of life. That's if we're lucky. Some people may have substantially more, but many of us have substantially less. How do we use this time wisely and well? These past 4 weeks in December just flew by, and they're gone. We are also finite in the amount of time we have to pursue various activities, work responsibilities, and family time. We are finite in our ability to do everything as good as we want to do it. We can be perfectionists, but we are finite in our ability to actually meet those perfectionistic ideals. We are imperfect people. We have only a limited supply of time and of energy, and then we die. And because we are finite, our choices matter. Making use of this present moment in all of its reality and imperfection is therefore critical. We must live in this moment right now. We cannot approach our life as if today is some sort of a preparation for future life in the hope of future healing. And there are several things that get in the way of surrender to this finitude. Chief among them can be fear. I'm going to pause, and there was a quote I wanted to share, and I'm trying to find it right now. Oliver Berkman is a British author and journalist who's written several books on this topic of finitude, and he says this: "There is a sense in which every moment of life is a last time. It arrives, you will never get it again, and once it has passed, your remaining supply of moments will be one smaller than it was before. To treat all of these moments solely as stepping stones to some future moment is to demonstrate a level of obliviousness to our real situation that would be jaw-dropping if it were not for the fact that we all do it all the time." Why do we fear dying? As Woody Allen says, "I'm not afraid of death, I just don't want to be there when it happens." I think there are a few reasons why we fear the process of dying. One of those is physical pain. There's a fear that my dying, my loss, my decline during whatever time frame we're talking about is going to involve some physical pain. And for some people, this actually is, of course, very true. There are certain types of disease processes, there are certain types of cancers in particular that can manifest with a certain amount of pain and pain challenges. Typically, I would say, in my experience, and I'm going to ask for Teresa's assertion on this as well, that that physical pain is something that we really are very good at managing. And I can give a lot of reassurance to my hospice patients when we're dealing with this, that their physical pain is something that we are very adept at managing. But it remains a fear for a lot of people. Another fear for people is this loss of control. This, again, is definitely true. We lose control of our ability to drive. Giving up driving is a huge thing for people. And then we lose our ability sometimes to walk, and then sometimes to manage our bladder and our bowels. And for some, this loss of control can feel like a loss of dignity. And that gets to be a real challenge for people. But in fact, there can be a richness in this loss of control and this reliance on others. Tied in with this fear of loss of control is this idea people have of a great fear of being a burden to their loved ones. When we were in pre-talk, Warren had raised the issue that a lot of people sometimes just seem to assume that they're going to rely on their loved ones to take care of them, and this is true, but it's also very true that a lot of people have the opposite idea, that they really do not want to be a burden to their loved ones, and they fear very much that they are. And a very common response, of course, from their kids is, "Oh, Dad, you're not a burden." And they're wrong, because they are a burden, and there's no denying it. This is an eyes wide open kind of a talk we're having here. It is not correct that they are not a burden. They are a burden, and we need to recognize that, and then we can embrace that in ways that are meaningful. And I lost my space here again. Darn it all. Darn it all. And I'm going to talk a little bit about my father. So my dad was diagnosed at the age of 52 with Parkinson's disease, and Dad died at the age of 62. And my father, perhaps like many of your fathers, and perhaps like many of you, was a strong guy. He was a determined man. He was clearly the leader of the family, leader in his community. He was a veterinarian. And Dad told me many times how much he did not want to be a burden to somebody else, and he did not want to end up in a nursing home. And so Dad then, it felt so just terribly ironic that Dad then got Parkinson's disease, where he was forced to have this continual gradual decline. And what I noticed with my father is that as he and my mother navigated this, and there was some switching of roles there, where Mom became the caregiver and the decision maker and the person of some more authority in all of this, that there was a real richness. I mentioned this earlier. There was a richness in that dynamic changing. For the two of them, they'd had a long marriage, but it was a marriage that had challenges, and it was a marriage that had hurts. And what I seemed to see with the two of them as this kind of dynamic flipped, that there was some opportunity for some healing in some of all of that, that perhaps might not have taken place if this hadn't happened. So it's something I've been paying attention to. And another thing that we fear is grief, the loss of time and connection with our loved ones. We've come up with some different ways of avoiding or sometimes resolving this fear of dying. Among avoidance is hope for miraculous healing. So in this case, hope and fear become two sides of the same coin. Hope is something that we use to avoid our fear. And many people hope for a miracle of healing, whether the source of that miracle is a faith in Jesus or a faith in science. And the biblical Jesus did perform many acts of healing in the Gospels, stories where he heals lepers, helps the lame walk, helps the blind see. And there are also some stories where he raises people from the dead. The most well-known of those, of course, would be Lazarus, the brother of Mary and Martha. Lazarus died and was in a tomb for 4 days before Jesus showed up and raised him from the dead. It's a wonderful story, but these stories of healing and of raising from the dead are left unended. They are open, and the question of what happened after that is not answered in these Bible stories. We are left to assume something along the lines of, "And he or she lived happily ever after." When I was young, I guess I assumed that all of those who were healed lived long and full lives and died in their sleep at the age of 100. Instead, it seems very likely that many of those who were healed in these stories, if any of this actually even occurred, but if any of those were healed, who were healed, they died or succumbed to disease or injury, some short, however we're going to define short, but some short while later, they all did die. Even Lazarus, eventually, permanently, died. There are those who emphasize the more scientific stories of unexpected healing, such as people who survived cancer. And again, the assumption is that there's a long and a full life that awaits for them after their healing. We sure hope they did not get in a bad car accident a few months later, but some of them did. Death due to something and at any age is, in fact, non-negotiable, and there is no magic age at which it becomes more meaningful or okay. Another thing that we use to avoid this fear of dying is we use this metaphor of fighting. Fighting versus, by the way, the other side of fighting is surrender and giving up. And this is a big one. In our Western mind frame, the disease becomes an enemy in the body, and the body is a battleground. disease is an attack, and medicine becomes a weapon. Winning this battle or this war means being cured, and dying is being defeated. Therefore, if your treatment is as agonizing as the disease, well, then war is hell. Doctors and nurses become generals, knights in shining armor, and heroes until, of course, the patient dies. And, of course, patients die. As we used to say in the emergency department, all bleeding stops eventually. Given this metaphor of fighting, if you don't elect to pursue treatment, this counts as giving up. You therefore become a coward or a deserter. And unfortunately, given this metaphor, we all lose eventually. I had a lady in her mid-70s with lung cancer. This was several years ago. She was finished with third-line chemotherapy and had still had progression of diseases, and she was being offered fourth-line chemotherapy, and she didn't want to do it. But she was very afraid that the people in her church were going to view her as a coward and as lacking faith in God. And in her case, we ended up having one of the church elders come and talk with her, and thankfully, this was a man of wisdom. And he sat with her, and he spoke with her, and he reassured her, and he gave her love and compassion, and she was able to acquiesce to that, and she was able to decide for herself that she did not want to do fourth-line chemotherapy, and that instead she was ready to do hospice care. But it took a clear, eyes wide open addressing of her concerns that she was going to be seen as a coward. No one ever really wins the battle, if we define it that way, and we can get so caught up in our fighting that we miss out on the living, and we miss out, I'm going to use the word again, on the richness of dying. This then bumps us into physician-assisted suicide, which I didn't know quite where to put. I'm going to say just a very brief thing on this, which is that I am conflicted on the topic. I will say that it needs to be talked about, and it may need to be offered. But if so, it needs to be offered with care. It does seem like it could be something to do as a way of somebody regaining some of their control and being able to manage things in their terms and to avoid some physical suffering, and there is a great deal of value in that. And there are challenges in that. It would also come at the loss of some of those opportunities to be with our loved ones in the dying slash living process and losing out on some of those very meaningful opportunities. And I'll say one last thing about my father. So a few weeks ago, I believe in pre-talk, I shared that when my dad was in his decline and he was in his last year or so of life, I was still working in the emergency department, and at that time, medications weren't as carefully locked down as they are now. And I use the word liberated. I liberated medications that I thought, knew, would be able to use for my dad to do physician-assisted suicide. I mentioned my dad was a veterinarian. Dad had euthanized many animals, and he had said in the past that he thought that we were kinder to our pets than we were sometimes to our loved ones by allowing euthanasia for our pets. So I knew that Dad had some openness to this. And so on one day, quietly when he and I were alone in the house, I did go to my father and I said, I have the ability to put an end to this if you want to do that. And my dad said no. And I'm very grateful he said no. But it was one of those things where it seemed important for him to have the choice. And so this is kind of where we're at with those things. By the way, the statute of limitations on those medications is long gone. So we won't talk about that. There are some ways in which we can help, however, to resolve rather than avoid our fear of dying. And one of those things that we can do is we can change our language and we can change our metaphors. And instead of using words like battle and war and fighting, we could talk instead about our story, and we could talk about our journey. We could avoid some of the harsh words like, this is excruciating, and excruciating may be exactly the right word to use at times, but sometimes I find that there's a harshness in the language that we use when we talk about the excruciating grief, and we can sometimes dial some of that language back, and we can also allow for the opportunity to say, okay, there's grief and there is still joy in some of these things. So I think language is one of those things that we can do. We can also change our attitude. You guys remember Gilda Radner? What a great gal. I have a picture in my mind of her laughing. I just always think of that when I hear her. She says this, I wanted a perfect ending. Now I've learned the hard way that some poems don't rhyme. Some stories don't have a clear beginning, middle, and end. Life is about not knowing, having to change, taking this moment and making the best of it without knowing what's going to happen next. Delicious ambiguity. That's a really neat phrase there. Delicious ambiguity. Other ways that we can resolve our fear of death and the dying process is that we can talk about it and we can bring it into the light. This came up in pre-talk on how there's this general idea, as I think Brad has alluded to during this series, that, oh, this is a morbidity, this is so dark, and it doesn't have to be, and we can talk about it and we can bring it into the light. In La Crosse, Wisconsin, many of you know this, but back in the 80s, their community, through an association with their large hospital system, began a program called Respecting Choices, and the idea behind this was to normalize end-of-life discussions and planning ahead. It even led into the development of something they called death cafes, and many of them are still around. We had one in Grand Rapids for about 3 years. It didn't last. It died. One of the ways that we can help to resolve our fear of death is we can plan for it. So one of those, there are some really concrete things that we can do as gifts to ourselves and to our families. Deciding on your code status. Do I want CPR or do I not want CPR? Do I want to be on a ventilator or do I not want to be on a ventilator? What about therapies like chemotherapy, dialysis, and feeding tubes? These are all nuts and bolts parts of this discussion that I'm not going to query every one of you on today. But in private, we will. And Teresa's here as well, and Jeff Crandall is, I didn't see Jeff here, but Jeff's very adept at all of this as well. But there are some very concrete nuts and bolts decisions that we can make, and we arguably should make. They will make your life easier, they will make the life of your loved ones easier. And among those also is designating somebody as your medical durable power of attorney. So picking somebody in your life who's going to help make medical decisions for you when you are not able to make them for yourself. And that could happen to me, by the way. I could get in my car when I leave here today and get a head injury, and I need to rely on somebody else to help me make my decisions. Talk with your loved ones about your wishes, such as where you want to be, how you want to meet your increasing care needs, because that's going to happen, right? Lots of us are older. We live with a loved one, or maybe we live alone, and we live independently. But it doesn't take rocket science to figure out that at some point you are going to need more help. I'm going to need more help, and to have very frank and open discussions about how am I going to get more help, what is that going to look like, how am I going to finance it. This is a fun topic to talk about. Finally, we can live. We can stop sleepwalking through our lives, live more intentionally in each moment. We cannot go through life as if our happiness will come again at some future time, be dependent on a change in our circumstances. We must avoid this idea that at some later date we will have enough time, enough money, enough health, enough energy to finally find well-being. Now is the time to love. Now is the time for joy. Now is the time to connect with your loved ones. We can live each day as if it were our last. And that's a cliche, but it has some value. So when I say we can live each day as if it's our last, well, that could mean we follow the example of Mark Smith and Mary Ellen Micah and we go and do the Camino Trail in Spain. These are the kinds of things that loom for me when I talk about if this is my last day, I'm gonna do something big. I'm gonna do a big cruise, or I'm gonna do a big trip. I'm gonna do a big meal. I'm gonna have wild sex. I'm gonna have some sort of really blowout day that's going to define this is my last day. And Ryan Halliday, who's a Stoic author and practitioner, has a different way of approaching it. He suggests that we compare living our last day as if we are a soldier going off to war the next day with some uncertainty as to when we return or how we return, and to take that day as a day that has meaning and value, and what are my priorities going to be if this is my last day. I also saw a meme. It had to do with, in the context of somebody who had the ability to do some time travel. And this person in this meme said, "I don't time travel like I used to. Instead, I choose to approach this day as if I have come back from some future self to live this day, that there's something special about this day that I'm going to choose to prioritize." And I really like that as well. I forgot to change something on my iPad so that I could just leave it up here without it blanking out on me. So we've been talking about dying. I'm going to change it just a tad and talk about death. Why do we fear death? Death is unknown, and the unknown can be scary, but there can be joy in the mystery. The quote here I'm going to have is from the TV show The Good Place. You guys ever watch that? It paraphrases some Buddhist thoughts about death. He says this: picture a wave in the ocean. You can see it, measure it, its height, the way the sunlight refracts when it passes through, and it's there, and you can see it, you know what it is, it's a wave. And then it crashes into the shore and it's gone. But the water is still there. The wave was just a different way for the water to be for a little while. The wave returns to the ocean where it came from and where it's supposed to be. I like that one. Regret. Regret's another one that gets in our thoughts about death itself. And regret is that many of us have regrets of our past actions and hurts that we've caused. We have a deep desire to redeem ourselves. Death can seem like the loss of the opportunity for redemption. That's a big one for a lot of people. In response to this, I love a quote that was attributed to C.S. Lewis. He says this: "You cannot go back and change the beginning, but you can start where you are and change the ending." How are we doing on time? Okay. Thanks. I'm going to close with a description of a scene in a movie. I was hoping to show it, but technical difficulties and all of that. So are you guys familiar with the Toy Story series of movies? Okay, you maybe know where I'm going with this already. But so Toy Story 1 was a great movie, and to everybody's surprise, Toy Story 2 was a great movie, and Toy Story 3 was an even better movie. And in Toy Story 3, the toys, they've kind of gotten moved out of the house somehow, something happened, and they're all trying to make their way back to their boy and their house. But they've ended up then in this dump, this garbage dump, and this is an incinerator dump. And the toys then are on this conveyor belt that is inevitably bringing them to this fiery furnace. Now, this is not a great movie scene to be, when I talk with patients, I'm not using this because of a... There's a fiery furnace, for one thing. But you can picture this. The toys are on the conveyor belt. They are struggling. They're running as hard as they can. They boost somebody up to climb the ladder to try and push the button, and it doesn't work, and the toys are toiling. They're just working as hard as they can. They are struggling as hard as they can to get out of this inevitable thing, and it doesn't work, and they get dumped then into this cone that's smooth, and it's just a cone that is leading down to the death, to the fire. And they you can see then at some point Buzz Lightyear begins to realize the struggle, there is no more struggle to be had. And when the cowgirl Jessie says, "Buzz, what are we going to do?" He does this. And he holds out his hand and she grabs hold of his hand. And then as the camera pans to the other various toys, they all start to witness this as well, and they all start to join hands together. And finally, there's the scene where Woody, who's the last toy to kind of struggle, and he's kind of there, and he brings his head up, and they make eye contact, and these two toys grab hold of their hands. And I will submit to you, because I get clamped when I talk about this, I will submit to you that that is not cowardice, that that is surrender, that it is a giving up in some ways, but that it takes a great deal of courage to do that. And so, since we're all here, I'm going to ask all of you, as you sit together next to someone, whether you know them or not, to take hold of their hand, just for now. We are living and dying, and we are dying and living. And the best way for us to approach that is with love and support of each other and care. So thank you.